Welcome to this panel, and congratulations on your discernment in picking the best panel at 9 a.m. on Saturday that has ever existed. I'm Deborah Kahn, a reporter for Environment and Energy Publishing, which is a subscription-based news service that covers environment and energy policy extremely closely. And thanks for coming to the panel. These are our illustrious panelists, and we're going to be discussing California transportation and energy policy, which has been very active lately, much more active and way more developments than I thought would be happening when I agreed to moderate this panel a couple months ago. So we'll have a pretty, I think, wide-ranging discussion, but let's see. I guess, should I just introduce you guys and then get started with it? Okay, so first we have Tiffany Roberts, who is an economist by training, and she is director of fuels and climate policy at the Western States Petroleum Association, which is the oil industry's main trade group out here, and it includes all the big oil companies, BP, Chevron, Shell, ExxonMobil, and a bunch of smaller ones, too. She came to WSPA fairly recently, a year and a half ago. She came from the Legislative Analyst's Office, which does analysis of bills and policies for the state legislature, so she is extremely sharp. Especially when it comes to the cap and trade program that's been in the news a lot lately that you guys may have heard about or have questions about. In the middle is Dan Sperling, who's kind of the great eminence of California transportation policy. I like to think of him as he wears two hats. He's wearing three because he's wearing a hat. And then there's two figurative hats as well. He's the director of UC Davis's Institute of Transportation Studies, and he's also a member of the Air Resources Board, which is the state agency that's in charge of getting California to its goals in 2020 of 1990 emissions levels, and then in 2030 of 40% below that. He is an engineering PhD, and he drives a hydrogen car, which he has outside in the parking lot, and he will show you if you want to see it. And then we have Simon Mui, who is in charge of California vehicle and fuels policy for the Natural Resources Defense Council, which is one of the major environmental groups that's active in California and nationally. He used to work for US EPA's Office of Transportation and Air Quality, so he's intimately acquainted with the ins and outs of electric vehicles and their effect on greenhouse gases. And he also has a PhD in materials engineering, so the technical side is his kind of bread and butter. So as a way of just kind of getting right into it, I'll ask an opening question that they can answer however they want to, and we'll see how they answer it, if they answer it, and then we'll go from there. So what is your favorite California transportation policy and why, and also what and or what is your least favorite?
Thank you, Deborah, and thank you for having us here today. It's a real honor to be here with you. And, you know, I appreciate the fact that working with the association now, it really gives me an opportunity to kind of wear the hat that I used to wear, which was a public policy hat. And I think one of the things that's really important, especially in the climate space, is to be able to talk about policy in a very balanced way and to be able to try to bring a very balanced approach to what we do. And so I do feel pretty lucky that I had the opportunity to work at the Ledge Analyst Office. For you guys, I don't know who's from California, maybe who's from out of state, but to give you guys an idea of who the Ledge Analyst is, it's kind of like the Congressional Budget Office. In fact, CBO was modeled after the Ledge Analyst Office, and so it really is the nonpartisan analyst for the California legislature. So my favorite transportation policy. Well, considering the fact that I walk to work and have walked to work for the past 6 years of my life, my favorite transportation policy is basically anything that has to do with kind of TOD, POD type of development. So I really am... Yes, transit-oriented development, pedestrian-oriented development. So I'm very much into the idea of urban infill. I absolutely appreciate having access to shops and being able to walk to work. That's one of the reasons that I live downtown. And so, you know, personally, I just appreciate that. And I think that Mr. Sperling might be a little surprised by that, but, you know, I think...
I don't think that's the WSPA position.
Well, we asked personally, right?
we'll get to that.
Absolutely. Alrighty, sir, what's your favorite?
Are you going to say your least favorite, sir?
Oh, Well, you got to tell your least favorite.
No. You don't have to. I just wanted to give you the option.
No, she does.
I do.
Because we're going to have fun about that.
We will. So I think just in terms of all of the transportation policies that are out there, probably the one that needs the most work, by no surprise, is the low-carbon fuel, LCFS, the low-carbon fuel standard. And I think for a lot of reasons that we'll get into today, there are things that we should be doing, thinking about in terms of how we might be able to improve that program.
And the reason I wanted Tiffany to say that is because my favorite is the low-carbon fuel standard. And in many ways, it's probably the second most important. The vehicle greenhouse gas standards, I think, are the most important in terms of having a big impact, but that's kind of too easy. But I think the low-carbon fuel standard is perhaps more controversial, partly because WISPA is so hostile to it. We're not recording this, are we?
We are recording.
Oh, we are. All right. But I think it's my favorite, partly because I confess I had something to do with the design of it. But I was involved in the design because I did think it was important, and I think it's a really important and probably the most important. Certainly after the vehicle standards, it's the most important in some ways, even more. And that's because, one, it's a good policy. It's performance-based. It's also market-based because the credits are tradable, so it creates a market. It's life cycle-based, so it takes into account the whole, all of the life cycle emissions. And it's the first major policy in the country, maybe the world, that has done that. And so it's an important model. And lastly, because it's the only policy that actually requires the oil industry to invest in low-carbon fuels. We can get into why I say that in a moment. But so it is really important because it brings the oil industry to the table, and they're not quite to the table yet, but they will be soon. So maybe I'll just leave it at that, and then I can, or maybe I'll, okay, my least favorite, just for fun, for all those you out there that are listening to it taped, I would say is cap and trade. Cap and trade is important symbolically. Cap and trade is important because it starts to impute a price of carbon, but in practice it has very little effect on investment and innovation so far. I know others embrace it, I think more for the symbolic value, and it'll be important long term. But for now, it's my least favorite.
Good morning. Thanks to Deborah for inviting me to speak. You know, when she asked me to come on a Saturday morning, the first thought that went in my head was, uh-oh, it's my wife's birthday weekend. I tried to convince her to come and threw in some Saturday museum tours and all of this, and ultimately you can see that I'm alone here. But I was actually excited to come because we're here to actually celebrate another birthday, which Deborah wrote on Thursday, which is actually the 10th anniversary of AB 32 as of next week when it was signed into law 10 years ago. And I think that's kind of this context we're going to be talking about today and the various policies. And one of the important things to remember is that AB 32 is actually a whole, it's kind of an umbrella of many different measures that are targeted to reduce emissions in that sector. It's kind of like a toolbox, if you might think of that, with cap and trade, maybe the screwdriver, and low carbon fuels, the saw, and you've got clean cars. I mean, all of them are working together. You kind of need all of them to build a house or your table. You can probably do a little bit with one, but you're probably not going to get the whole job done, and you use the right tools for the job you need. In terms of my favorite policy, I would say the Zero Emission Vehicle Program, just because of, you know, the underdog nature. I'm always for underdogs, and the underdog nature of it for the past two decades and how it's emerged as one of the key drivers for electric vehicles. Now, my least favorite policy is the Zero Emission Vehicle Program, and that is because it's one of the hardest programs to work on. It is very, very complicated. What used to be a pure sales target for the automakers to issue out pollution-free vehicles has become pretty complicated. So complicated, in fact, that we had to hire an ex-ARB, not Dan, but a retired ARB official who ran the program back in the 2000s to actually tell us how many vehicles does it actually require. And that's because it's based on a credit structure. So we are, in fact, I think that's one of the, maybe that's your second question, one of the areas to focus on over the next year or two to really tune up the Zero Emission Vehicle Program. You know, it's like one of those, your favorite old car that, you know, you can't seem to, you don't want to get rid of, but it definitely needs a tune-up.
Thanks, Simon. And that was going to be my next question. You know, which of these many policies that California has needs the most urgent attention? And it sounds like Simon definitely thinks the ZEV policy is. The study that he commissioned from the former ARB official, I think we're at like 1% of adoption, 1% of new car sales are ZEVs now, is that right? And that we're on track to do 6% now, or is 3? Okay.
We're at 3%, and the original target was 1.5 million, which is in California is the governor's target, official state target, 15% sales by 2025, and one of the standard, when you go back and actually see what it requires, it's effectively ends up being only 6% sales by 2025. So we definitely need to turn up the ramp towards 2025, particularly to meet 2030 targets. And that is one of the areas. And I also have to just throw in, I agree, you know, low carbon fuel standards probably pretty high on my list as well.
Okay. I was hoping maybe Dan or somebody can give us an idea of what you think the mix is going to be to get us where we need to go. I mean, transportation is actually the largest contributor to greenhouse gases in California. It's 37%, which is much larger than electricity, which is like 20%. So we've been having a lot of success in reducing our greenhouse gases from electricity. You could argue, you know, are we sending some of them out of state? Possibly. But for mobile sources, for transportation, it's proving much more difficult. So we have a bunch of policies, but what is it going to be, mostly electric? What's it going to look like in 2030?
Well, there's two parts to that. One is, what is the policy mix that's needed? And then the other question is, on the ground, what's going to actually be important? And I would say, in terms of the policy mix, California has done a really good job on the policy mix for transportation. I think that we're pretty much on track to get the kinds of reductions that we're aiming for, the 40% in 2030 and 80% in 2050. It does imply a continued tightening of the different policies and standards. But if we just stay on the trajectory we're on, I think we're fine. And we've, unique in the world, we have probably about the right mix of policies. We have the vehicle standards, which are, of course, national and California. We've got the ZEV mandate, which eases the transition, kind of keeps car companies from procrastinating. That's really what it does, so that when they reach the 54 or 50 miles per gallon as required, they'll have the technology in place, they'll have the experience to keep on that trajectory of about 4% per year improvement in greenhouse gases, transitioning to plug-in hybrids, battery EVs, fuel cells. So we have that, you know, so on the vehicle side, the low carbon fuel standard we have in place. As we'll be tightening that up soon. It's 10% reduction in carbon intensity by 2020, and it'll be, you know, 15-20% carbon intensity in 2030. And then we have the policy on Mobility, Passenger Use, and Land Use, SB 375, Sustainable Communities Act, and that's probably the weakest of all of them. It doesn't really have any real teeth to it yet, and so that's the challenge there, so we can get those that transit-oriented development and getting more people to get out of their car and move in other ways that are lower carbon. That needs more work. But the basic policies are in place. And so where are we going to be? Well, certainly in 2050, it's pretty easy to predict, certainly for California, that we'll have almost all electric drive vehicles, meaning plug-in hybrids, battery EVs, and fuel cell vehicles. And this is light duty, by the way. Everything we've been talking about so far is light duty. And maybe we want to get into freight at some point and trucks, because light duty actually is much easier than heavy duty. So I think that, you know, actually, remarkably, we're on the right path and got the right policies, and we have the vision on how it's going to happen. I don't know if everyone on the panel embraces it, but that's how I see it. And I think I can say ARB sees it that way as well.
You know, one of the things that I think is really interesting at this point, whenever you ask, what's the most pressing issue, I think even probably a month, maybe 2 months ago, we would have said one thing. And now, just in the past few weeks, we might actually say something else. And I think, really what it comes down to is the fact that there's a lot of conversations that are happening around the cap and trade program and what is going to happen post 2020 with the cap and trade program. As everybody knows, SB 32 was passed and it put a target in place of 40% below 1990 levels, but unfortunately it didn't say anything. It was silent on the cap and trade program. Ledge analyst offices weighed in and said you need authorization post 2020. Ledge council has weighed in and said you need authorization post 2020 in order to continue the cap and trade program. So that's one of the things that I think that's sitting out there that's still kind of this unknown. It's an uncertainty. I think the other piece of that puzzle too is the fact that now we're hearing much more from the environmental justice community. And the environmental justice community is saying, hey, wait a second. You know, we've raised issues in the past about the cap and trade program. We want to look at some different options. And so as part of that, they've even thrown in the idea of a carbon tax. They've also thrown out numerous ideas around transportation, around industry caps and what have you. But I think the bottom line is that the ARB really at this point is going to have to go back and do some very rigorous analysis, not only around kind of a post-2020 target scoping plan as it's currently envisioned, but you really are hearing from the environmental justice community that they want a very vigorous analysis around all of these other options as well. And so at this point, because of that uncertainty, I mean, I think there's a lot of different directions that the overall package, the suite of measures, as Simon referenced earlier, a lot of different directions that could go.
I just want to ask a follow-up on that pretty quick. So are you saying that the uncertainty introduced by the environmental justice movement is driving WISPA more directly to embrace cap and trade? No?
No, I mean, I think, here's the thing. You know, whenever we look at command and control regulations versus market mechanisms, the thing that we understand is that incentives work. And so to the extent that you can have a program in place that really incentivizes the market to move in a certain direction, we would always say that a market mechanism is going to be better than command and control. So you've got a couple of different options for a market mechanism. That's a carbon tax. That's a cap and trade program. So I wouldn't say that it would push us in either direction, but rather, you know, we would want to emphasize that we definitely prefer a market mechanism over command and control.
I think what Tiffany is also referring to in terms of the conversation changing over the past several weeks is for folks who aren't in California, the passage of SB 32 just this past month and the signing this month, which essentially extends California's climate programs out beyond 2020 to 2030 and sets the new target Now, there's differences on this table regarding cap and trade and cap and trade program explicitly continuing. You know, we tend to view cap and trade as basically continuing, given the signal by the legislature. It's obviously one of the key measures. You know, one of the things that I, in terms of the issues being brought up by the environmental justice community, is the lack or the need to focus more heavily on some of the stationary sources. A lot of the reductions thus far have been through transportation, through the renewable portfolio standard, less so from efficiency stationary source reductions. These are industrial sources of emissions. And those, obviously, many of those facilities border communities that are disadvantaged. We work with a lot of the environmental justice community. We help pass support SB 32 with many in the EJ community. So I think this idea that somehow cap and trade is not part of the program and is being thrown out, overboard, is a little bit further than I think a lot of EJ community members would say. But the important part of that is that the focus. How do you make the cap and trade program work better? How do you make climate programs in general more focused to tackle some of the air pollution, the local air pollution that is on these communities? There's different ways of doing that. ARB is obviously looking at these post 2020 in terms of trying to maximize co-pollutant reductions. These are criteria emissions at sites together with GHG emissions. And they don't necessarily have to be in conflict, because a lot of the things you do to reduce greenhouse gas emissions also helps with criteria emissions as well.
I'm going to be more frank and direct than the and less diplomatic here. At the high level, I would agree with Tiffany that if you look at policy in a theoretical, generic way, you'd say market instruments are the way to go. We're in a market economy, change market signals. That's definitely right. But if you look at the reality of the politics of greenhouse gas policy, let me use low carbon fuel standard as an example. So WISPA loves to beat up on the low carbon fuel standard, and they say they have all kinds of criticisms of it. But the point is that a carbon tax would be a lot better from an economic efficiency perspective than the low carbon fuel standard to get reductions. You could do it. It would be at less, if you had a carbon tax, it would take less cost to the economy to reduce the carbon intensity. But you know what that means? That means a carbon tax of $10 a gallon or something like that to get the same reduction as we're going to get through the low carbon fuel standard. It ain't going to happen politically. No politician is going to vote for even a 50 cent a gallon price increase, never mind a $5 or $10. So therefore, we go to what economists call a second best solution, low carbon fuel standard. It's a performance standard, but it does use the market in terms of the credits are tradable between companies. So yes, and there's the literature, there's some great economists that have done some good analysis, say, you know, low carbon fuel standard is not the most efficient. It's like, okay, thank you, professor. Speaking as a professor, that's interesting. And now let's move on to reality. And the reality is, and so you go back to cap and trade, it's the same thing. So the cap and trade is $10 a ton. That's equivalent to about 10 cents a gallon. It has almost zero effect, certainly on the transportation fuel side, and even on the industrial side, has very little effect. Now, if you give me $100 a ton price for cap and trade, okay, now we can talk. Now we're going to see innovation. We're going to see investment. We're going to see change. But that's not going to happen for a long time, and that's why the regulatory approaches are by far are much more important than cap and trade or a carbon tax will be, and for a very long time, and because politically we're not going to get the prices we need, you know, through a carbon tax or a cap and trade to kind of make the differences that we will have with the vehicle standards. Look at the vehicle standards, for instance. Go to Europe. Europe does have a $4 or $5 a gallon gasoline tax, and yet they still see the need to put vehicle standards, CO2 standards in place, even with $4 a gallon tax. So that tells you the market just doesn't work efficiently to get the changes that we want. And that's why we're doing the vehicle standards. That's why we're doing the low carbon fuel standard. That's why we're doing the zero emission vehicle mandate. That's why we're doing the renewable portfolio standards. And we're not going to be able to get around that for a very long time. We do need the carbon prices, and ideally, hopefully, they'll get bigger and be more important, and then there'll be some politicians will have a little more backbone and be willing to do it, but that's not going to happen for a long time.
Okay, I want to jump in.
Should I be sitting between you two?
No, not at all. This is good. This is good. I like this. We need more dialogue like this. I mean, honestly, that's really what we need. Okay, a couple of things. Just in terms of kind of the political reality, I mean, I think we could probably look back 10 years and, you know, if we're thinking about the history of AB 32 and how far we've come, I'm sure there were people back in 2006 and prior to that who said, well, that's not politically feasible. So in my mind, I think that facing a post-2020 program where you're going to have a two-thirds vote on a cap-and-trade program, I wouldn't say that it is completely and totally infeasible. I think that what really is important is for folks to come to the table and figure out how best to do it. And that happens through conversations like this and through good dialogue and good analysis. The other point that I would make, too,
but Tiffany, the one point on that is they might adopt it, but it's not going to be aggressive enough to have a high price.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Let's talk about that. Okay, so a lot of the work that's been done looking at the cap and trade program and looking at complementary measures, we've looked at the interactions between the suite of complementary measures and the cap and trade program. And it's kind of like squeezing on a balloon whenever you have a price on carbon. You're basically squeezing or forcing certain emission reductions to happen through mandates if you've got complementary measures in place. Now, what would happen if you were to back out some of the complementary measures, if you were to reduce the pressure on the balloon? You would have price shifting over to the cap and trade program so that you don't have a static price on carbon. Rather, you would see the actual cost of allowances, the price of allowances, increasing. And so I think that's really the crux of the conversation. How do we do this in a way that is going to send a real, true price signal? And that's one of the reasons that we've said in the past, if you are to back off of the low carbon fuel standard, then you would allow the cap and trade market to work. Right now, it's somewhat constrained. I think the other side of it, too, is the realization that the California is 1%, less than 1% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions. And so what we have to do as an incubator for policy here in this state is to figure out how to make it exportable. How are we going to put policies in place that work for all of California? And if we're able to do that, if we're able to prove going forward that it's workable, then I think more and more you're likely to see other states and other countries follow us. Right now, I think the program, I mean, we're only a couple of years into the cap and trade program. So I would also say that we need to let it work. We want to see if it's going to work rather than jumping to conclusions prematurely that say that it doesn't.
We would also love to see it work well. The litigation that WISPA is and other industry groups on cap and trade is part of the reason why some of that uncertainty is there. I think that's well acknowledged. So we hear you that you like cap and trade. as a policy. We know that in transportation, it's very easy to just add on the amount back to consumers. Like Dan said, I think a lot of the things that the oil industry is capable of doing, we do not see happening without a direct policy. And that's why we actually see both cap and trade together with these measures working together. They are different tools to tackle different problems. So I'll just give folks an example. Let's put ourselves in a refinery manager's shoes. So there's a price signal, a cap and trade price signal. I can either reduce emissions, maybe I'll do some combined heat and power, maybe I'll integrate some energy efficiency. The price is $14 per ton. And, you know, I can decide whether to do some reductions or I can decide to do purchase allowances from somebody else that has done those reductions. So in that example, maybe that makes sense. Now let's put ourselves in an automaker engineer's shoes who is in charge of product development. They see the carbon price of $12, $14 out there. Again, Dan said, you know, about 10 cents, 11 cents effectively. That engineer, that product developer, is probably going to say, so what? I'm going to make my vehicle. If they see instead a standard that says, by the way, you need to reduce the emissions of those products going forward by 50% over 15 years. I know what to do as an engineer. I know what to do as a product planner. I know the mix of technologies I have to achieve those targets. The cap and trade just does not play into the decision making. So these are different examples. I can go, you know, into the city planner. City planner, we know we got to reduce, right? Create more transit-oriented developments. If I'm a city planner and I'm planning out whether I want to build high-density housing, more walkable streets, transit investments, my guess is the carbon price out there right now isn't really changing those decisions. But if I have a requirement to, in my planning process, to consider the additional emissions, the vehicle miles traveled associated with my plan, and that requirement tells me I need to consider that in my process and reduce my emissions from that giant, you know, project over that metropolitan area, I'm much more likely to design a roadmap going forward that roadmap's the wrong word, a transit map going forward that actually reduces those miles, that allows people to live in neighborhoods that have access to transit, have access to bike lanes. The carbon price is not the right tool for that, right? So I think, you know, I'm in violent agreement that with Tiffany that we need cap and trade. I'm in violent agreement that with Dan that we need complementary measures. We need both for different reasons. They're different tools.
Yeah, I would like to. Just very briefly, and I'm only going to touch on this because I do think it's an important point. Simon brought up the lawsuit, and I think one of the things that gets, to a certain extent, kind of skewed a little bit is this idea that somehow the business industry is anti AB 32. The lawsuit's not about being against AB 32. What it comes down to is the question of whether AB 32 allowed the state to raise billions and billions of dollars without, essentially a proceed of tax, treating it as a proceed of tax without having the requisite two-thirds vote. So that was the question. And I do think it's important to kind of make that distinction. In terms of the industry kind of dragging its feet, I keep hearing that. And I want to challenge that. I'm going to push back on that. And here's why. Because the oil and gas industry from 2000 to 2014 has invested $90 billion in low emission and zero emission technology. It dwarfs what the auto industry has invested, which is $37 billion. And so the idea that somehow we're not pushing the envelope, we're not investing in technology, I mean, they're businesses. And so businesses are going to look forward, and they're going to look at what customers are demanding in the future. I mean, I think we can even look most recently at one of the oil companies that has now agreed to purchase Verint. And Verint is a company, it's basically a biofuels company that looks at how to convert sugars and other biomass into usable fuel. And so I don't think it's a question of if the industry is actually doing something. We very much are doing something. The larger question is, what's the right path forward? You had mentioned electric vehicle technology. I mean, looking at the analysis that's been done, or some analysis that was contracted by the Air Resources Board from a firm called E3, and E3 looked at a couple of different paths forward. And one of the things that they determined is that you are going to have a very high penetration of electric vehicles. The analysis called out 6 to 8 million electric vehicles that would need to be on the road by 2030. And so if you look at the numbers today where we're at with electric vehicles, it's between 150, 200. You're going to know this number better than I am. But we're only at 200,000 electric vehicles, and we're talking less than 15 years out. So really what it comes down to is having some type of black swan event in the market in order to really push customers to use that, in order to really get to where the state's looking to go. And I think that's one of the reasons that it is fundamentally important to have market-based programs, because it's in the market where you're going to have that type of revolutionary R&D and that type of technological development.
So can I... Well, okay, just a little response on the EV, but I want to come back to the statement about the oil industry commitment. So EVs, there are far more EVs now being sold in China than the U.S. Norway is already at 35% market penetration. So even if we had 6 million vehicles, EVs, in 2030, that's still only 6 out of about 30 million. So it's still only about 20% of sales. It's not even sales. It's even, we'll say it's 20% of the fleet. So it's a significant number, but it's, I mean, the technology is here already today. Yes, it's a little bit more expensive, but the battery costs are coming down. The fuel cell costs are coming down. So in 15 years to get to 20 or 30% market penetration does not seem like that big a lift, especially because the auto industry, unlike the oil industry, has made truly a massive commitment to moving to very efficient, low-carbon technologies. So to come back, you know, Tiffany, you quote this $90 billion number. I don't know what that's referring to. I suspect it includes corn ethanol mostly. Investments that a lot of the oil companies have made. I don't exactly call that a commitment to low carbon technology. It's just business as usual. There has been some of the oil companies have put some effort into it, some real effort, but not very much. And there's been essentially almost no investment in advanced biofuel technologies that would be actually low carbon. Can't get the oil companies to invest in hydrogen stations, even though it's a trivial amount of money. In fact, the oil industry fought tooth and nail against a requirement that they put in hydrogen stations. So I would greatly contest the idea that the oil industry is making much of a commitment. In any case, it's much less than the electric utility industry is doing, and much less than the automobile industry is doing.
Okay. I'm sure we can go on in this vein for the rest of the session. But I was thinking we'd maybe change tacks a little bit. So you mentioned that we need a black swan moment or some kind of event to get us to EV penetration. But what about, I mean, I'm kind of wondering just about the effect of a price signal in general. It seems like both ARB and WISPA are, I don't know if you want to or if you are masking whatever price signal would get passed through to consumers. It seems like that's the goal here, right? I mean, otherwise it seems like you're fearing there's going to be some, like, as soon as gas prices go up in an attributable way to any of these programs, you know, there's going to be a ballot initiative that'll just overturn everything. So what... this is a consumer question. I mean, this is a psychology question. We haven't really talked about people, but it's people who need to buy these cars, right? And so what do we – is it a psychological thing that we can get at with prices, or is it a range anxiety thing? Or Simon?
Yeah, and I would actually – you know, as an environmental group, you know, folks – thinks that all these environmentalists want to jack up prices or something on fossil fuels. I think, in truth, what we are about is ultimately reducing emissions. So if Tiffany and her engineers at the organization she represents can figure out how to make a cleaner fuel, we are for that. A lot of the policies we push, if you look at the AB 32 climate change portfolio, it's heavily, heavily focused on energy efficiency. We've been working on energy efficiency programs for decades. One of my colleagues, Noah Horowitz, just put out a report about TV efficiency. One of the things that this actually does is actually reduce costs for consumers. And so we've had a lot of back and forth with WISPA about prices, but consumers ultimately pay bills, right? You pay your gasoline bill, you pay your electricity bill. These types of measures, there is no question that they're reducing the amount of energy we use. They are reducing our fuel bills, our electricity bills. UCLA did a report last year that looked at, across the sector, the impacts of AB 32, including cap and trade costs, on low-income and moderate-income families. You can look it up. It's a UCLA Luskin report. And what they found was actually that on net, consumers, both low-income and moderate, were benefiting from these policies, paying lower bills precisely because of the efficiency, but also other policies in place to protect consumers, such as on the electricity side, the cost going back as dividend, climate dividends to families. So essentially, the prices on the utility, any types of proceeds collected from that go straight back to families. But it still sets the right signal, right, upstream at the power producer level. We've had CARE, which is a program for lower-income families to make sure their electricity bills don't go out of hand. All of those policies work in tandem. UCLA found that they were saving money. Consumers Union, which is the policy arm of Consumer Reports, also did a study on transportation costs. What they found was when you look at these policies in total, yes, there are some compliance costs that affect prices, but because we don't buy so many units, we don't need so many, right? If you're in a vehicle that needs half the amount of fuel that it did 10 years ago, you're saving money. I'm sorry, you're not, you know, if prices go up 10 cents or down 10 cents, you are saving money at the end of the day, and that's been confirmed over and over by the National Academy, by EPA, by Consumers Union, looking at these types of impacts. So I think, you know, we are about policies that work ultimately for households. If we don't get this right, if we don't get climate policies right, it's got to be at the end also about people, about households, and about saving people money. So we think we can do both, and the history on this, the 10-year history, has been that we are doing both. We are increasing our economy while lowering energy costs. We are reducing emissions at the same time as our California's economy continues to grow. Pollution is not synonymous with economic growth.
Yeah, I'll jump in. You know, a couple of things. Just on the $90 billion, I don't think there is, I mean, that's a significant amount of money. So,
what is it?
Okay, and so that was a good point that you made as well. Dan mentioned the potential for ethanol investments. I remember back in the kind of late 90s, early 2000s, ethanol was the thing. It was the new thing. And so you had lots of kind of government movement towards incentivizing ethanol. I mean, that's really kind of what comes down to the problem with government mandates. One day we like it, the next day we don't. But that happened through the renewable fuel standard at the federal level. And so, yes, very much I think that our companies have looked at various ways to reduce emissions, low emission or zero emission technology, whether it's ethanol, cellulosic, or other types of investments. But in terms of what the utilities invested $37 billion. So again, I mean, I think when you compare that to what the federal government has invested in total, it's still not something that you want to sneeze at. Those are real dollars. Those are real investments. And again, if we don't know exactly what that path is going to look like, then I think we need to be open-minded about the types of investments that we're making to make sure that, again, you know, when you're thinking about what the path forward will be, that we're doing it in a way that is not restricting the market, not restricting incentives. It's not restricting human ingenuity, but allowing human ingenuity to work. In terms of the actual price to consumers, I mean, I think that's one of the things that we talk about a lot. I mean, the fact of the matter is consumers, in order for consumer behavior, and that's what you're getting at, right, the idea of economic behavior and economic response to various price signals, you've got to have a price signal in place in order to signal to consumers to move in one direction or the other. And to the extent that you blunt that price signal, you won't be moving in a certain direction. All of that said, I do think it's important to also consider the fact that in California, you basically have, I've heard people talk about the idea of two Californias. You've got coastal elites, you've got places in Silicon Valley, Beverly Hills, et cetera, who are experiencing tremendous economic growth. You've got places in the Central Valley, though, up and down the Central Valley, Imperial County, for example, whose unemployment rate is extremely high. And so while you might, on average, have economic growth, I think you need to look at where that economic growth is happening. And, you know, when we talk about this, I think really the message is make sure that the policy is working for all of California, not just the coastal elites or the very rich.
It just kind of struck me. It's interesting. Like if gas prices go up, then it could incentivize a switch to EVs, but it could also kind of incentivize a revolt against these policies, right? And it kind of depends which way we try to steer consumers.
That's right. So two points I want to make here, exactly where you were going there, Deborah, and that is that it's nice to say that we just want to rely on a price to make the changes, but the reality is so here I am, a professor lecturing on politics, but I guess I have to. And that is that the political system will not accept large increases in prices. And so to say that we're going to rely on market prices to achieve it and is just unrealistic and a way to kill the policies. Now, if you look at it from a consumer perspective, we've seen consumer and political perspective is that vehicle standards, for instance, as where Simon was alluding to a little bit, because of the vehicle greenhouse gas standards, consumers are saving huge amounts of money. Forget, you know, social benefits and externalities and all that stuff. It's costing about $1,000 to get vehicles up to 50 miles per gallon or so, and they're going to get back $3,000 or $4,000 in fuel cost savings over that time. So it's a great policy, and the explanation is because the way of consumer behavior and consumer purchases, you know, people tend to be conservative and they worry about resale value and so on, and so they're their behavior is not in alignment with what's socially good or even what's good for them as individuals. And I know it sounds a little paternalistic, but that is, you know, the real world. And so, yes, we want to send the right signal. I'm a huge champion of market instruments. I vote for that number one in principle. But in practice, we need all these others are going to be much more important in the coming years, whether you look at it from a consumer perspective, an industry perspective, or just a plain political perspective.
And I'll just add, I am one of those consumers that surprisingly works on fuel efficiency, but has never done a calculation when I'm in the vehicle market about, you know, lifetime. It's actually a complicated calculation. I've done it for work, but me as a consumer, when I'm standing next to my wife in the car dealership lot, we're you know, our decision-making process is about how we feel in that vehicle. And so the barriers here, right, are about, well, maybe we should be increasing the amount of consumer choice out there for fuel products. I mean, when I was in the market 2 years ago, and I did this because I'm kind of a nerd, so I looked up how many vehicles out there got over 40 miles per gallon. So 2014, 25 vehicle models got fuel economy, miles per gallon, over 40 miles per gallon. Now you look at 2010. How many vehicles do you think got over 40 miles per gallon? I'll tell you the answer. It's 3. Can anyone name those vehicles? Brownie points if you get all 3. I'm not going to let him answer. Honda Insight, Toyota Prius, and this one's a hard one. I actually got this wrong. A Honda Civic. So there were only 3 vehicles just 6 years ago that got over 40 miles per gallon. Just 2 years ago, 25. There's more now. And that's precisely because California's programs, right, drove federal standards, which is helping with international standards, right? 80% of the global vehicle market is now covered by GHG or fuel efficiency requirements, right? So it is about California's policy spreading beyond its borders. That's the importance. It's also about giving more choices out there, more, you know, a lot of people know how to do these sorts of things, and it's unleashing their ability to do so within the industry. And you look at SUVs as well, 25, you know, 3 times more options. So I'll stop there because okay. It sounds like we've got some questions.
Yeah, we're gonna open it up. Should have probably opened up like 10 minutes ago. So, yeah, Peter.
So the question was basically about the California Zero Emission Vehicle Program, which was adopted by 9 other states. And going forward, it is tightening up sort of the question and what that means is it is getting tighter over time. The issue right now is that because of a lot of the credit structures, the credit systems that were really developed maybe 15 years ago when there was, you know, when we were still writing about who killed the electric car, they gave a lot of extra credits, bonus credits for, you know, different types of technologies. So there's a whole backlog, a whole bank that's kind of following the program that industry has, which will affect future deliveries. There's also an issue of where we believe ARB underestimated for the first time what the technology could do. So ARB's assessment back in 2012 was that we would have a 70-mile battery electric vehicle on the market in 2025. Well, guess what? We've got a 238-mile Bolt next year, or this year really, coming out, and those vehicles will be getting a lot more credit. So industry to me, their targets actually need less vehicles, less and less vehicles. So that is definitely a place where, you know, I think we'll be looking at to tune up. The importance of this, is actually that California and these other clean car ZEV states have delivered globally 20% of the entire electric vehicle market, 20%. It's very outsized, the impact of these policies. So what that means is that 20% of the global market has been driven by California, essentially. Battery costs, we know, have come down by 65%. So if I were speaking to you 5 years ago, we'd be talking $1,000 per kilowatt hour. Right now, people are talking about $200 per kilowatt hour. Costs have come down over 65% in 5 short years. What that means is that globally, if you scale up this technology, costs are expected to come down even further. There's a sweet spot there, a tipping point perhaps, where if you get battery costs low enough, they are much more competitive, right, for consumers to utilize, and on top of being able to add on range. So we do believe that these policies are necessary to get that technology more massively commercialized, to bring down costs, and to make these really part of every automaker's portfolio. You know, just as renewables are now parts of utilities portfolio and growing over time, that is essentially kind of like, you can think of ZEV as the renewable portfolio standard for automakers.
To give just a quick answer in terms of the policy itself, so it is scheduled, as Simon was indicating, it's relatively flat right now in terms of the requirements in the car industry. In 2018, it starts increasing at a very steep rate. There is, I think, almost no possibility that it will be weakened from the way it's scheduled and designed to take effect. If anything, there might be so no backsliding is, I don't think it's conceivable in any context. There is a possibility it could be tightened up. There could be some small changes to it, but and that's speaking both as an ARB board member and an academic, that I think we're, and I would say it's, you know, overall, it's been a huge success in terms of, it's been a tortured path to get where we are, but it's been successful in terms of motivating and incentivizing industry to invest. And they're doing it now because they know that is the future, and it's keeping them from procrastinating. In some cases, companies are taking real aggressive investments. In other cases, they're just going along to meet the requirement.
Is there still extra credit for hydrogen versus batteries? How does that work?
Well, you know, whenever you... Okay, so one could get into a deep discussion on this, but the basic philosophy or approach is that you need to come up with a nuanced way of comparing different types of vehicles. A plug-in Prius is not the same as a Leaf, is not the same as a Volt, is not the same as a Bolt, not the same as a Tesla. So there needs to be some mechanism for converting to a formula for comparing them to meet, you know, the overall requirements. And you just can't... I mean, we simplified it in 2012. It used to be much more complicated. We simplified it. But you can't make it more simple than it is now, really, and unless you go to a pure market instrument, which would not work. So the answer is that there is different credits for different types of vehicles. So there is more for a fuel cell for the idea because it has longer range, and because it's earlier in its development and it's meant to incentivize it, incentivize more investment in it.
California policymakers have made a mistake by including fuels in the cap and trade program when we already had the low carbon fuel standard existing at the same time. And was it a mistake? Maybe Danny could address this too, to include transportation fuels in cap and trade and have the LCFS existing on at the same time.
You got me so excited by that second one that I already forgot the first one, but I'll end the second one. Professor Stavins is a very smart, excellent researcher, but he is completely wrong in his assessment, and I think he doesn't even really understand the LCFS from some of the writings he's done on it. And the first one was... Oh, yeah. Elon Musk is an ingrate. He should be so grateful to the ARB. As a result of way ARB has constructed the ZEV mandate, Tesla has gotten something like $600, $700 million in extra revenue from selling their credits to the car companies over the last few years. Now, there is a point, of course, to what he's saying after I get over the fact that he's... is so ungrateful for the gift he's been given. There's, as Simon suggested, there's lots of reasons to think about how to change the ZEV program, and there's lots of questions one could raise. I think at the end of the day, we're probably pretty much locked into what we have through 2025. We might make some changes, but we certainly should be thinking about some major changes after 2025.
I wasn't gonna say anything about Elon Musk, but on the fuels under the cap and the low carbon fuel standard and the interaction, the question was about Professor Stavins' work and his evaluation of the impacts that the programs have and kind of the interactions. For those of you who aren't familiar with Stavins, he's a professor at Harvard, and he has done a lot of work, especially on the carbon market side and looking at how climate policies work. The point is that if you've got fuels under the cap and you've got a low carbon fuel standard, you're basically going after that same molecule of carbon with two different programs. And so if you're doing that, you are going to have an interaction, and one is going to dull the other. And so to the extent that maybe we prefer a cap-and-trade program to a command-and-control program, you look at the impact that the low-carbon fuel standard having that emission reduction being forced via a low-carbon fuel standard, the analysis basically says that you're muting the impact that you could see through a carbon market. In other words, you're dulling the potential allowance price. And so I think there is some validity to that. I do think he is correct in comparing those two programs, and especially the interactions of the programs. I think it's also important to note that it's not just the LCFS. He hasn't put a bullseye on the LCFS per se. It's looking at any and all complementary measures, whether it's the RPS or other programs that are incorporated into the AB 32 scoping plan. And the fact of the matter is, the more that you force emission reductions in one area, the less you're going to allow the market to work. And again, you see that relationship. I think the analogy of squeezing on a balloon is a really good analogy, because you get the sense of what's going to happen with those carbon prices. And to the extent that you're dulling carbon prices via the low carbon fuel standard, you're disallowing the cap and trade program to work.
I roll my eyes.
That's okay. We'll still be friends. I'm still going to come see your car.
I go to
I lived in Cambridge for a number of years and was amazed by how accessible the tea was. When it runs, much better than some of the systems here. But I will say that, yes, the panel here is sort of focused on vehicles and fuels. We have, and I know the Air Resources Board and Department of Transportation is also heavily focused. In fact, there was a session last week or 2 weeks ago targeting how do we tackle essentially vehicle miles traveled, how do we tackle really the built environment, right, which is sort of locking us in into a very carbon-intensive pathway when you think about it. You know, I will speak for some of our work federally, looking at DOT, right, transportation infrastructure investments, the way that funding to states gets allocated, starting to think about how to put some performance metrics on those funds, that it isn't, you know, widening lane capacity, boom, you get your dollars. Well, maybe you need to think about alternative ways when you're allocating money to accomplish the same performance but with other types of systems. And we think that approach, and I'm not an expert on this, but I can put you in touch with one of our experts. But the basic idea is basically using that as a tool, actually, to encourage, incentivize regional decision-making, state decision-making. And, of course, in California, we talked a little bit about it, but SB 375 in terms of starting that sort of conversation, right, making it a requirement for all MPOs to basically come forward with plans that are shifting. And those are hundreds of billions of dollars that are actually being shifted going forward towards more transit-friendly, more sustainable communities, really.
We certainly have created a very car-centric transportation system. It started in Los Angeles, spread through California and the rest of the U.S., and now most of the world. And it's gone way too far. And I think almost all analysts would acknowledge that. We've created the most expensive, resource-intensive transportation system imaginable. And it doesn't even work that well. Now, having said that, I'm going to be a little politically incorrect here and say that, first of all, I'll make the observation. In the U.S., mass transit accounts for 3% of passenger miles traveled. 3%. Cars are over 80. Aviation's about 10. It's barely, from a climate perspective, it's a blip. And even worse, if you look at it in terms of greenhouse gases per passenger mile, buses are actually worse than cars. It's a kind of an inconvenient truth that no one wants to talk about. And most of us, including me, I didn't talk about it until very recently, and I am willing to talk about it now because until now there was no alternative. And transit is heavily subsidized is another part of it. You know, in the Bay Area and the LA area, over half of all the transportation money goes for transit, and yet only 5% of the passenger travel is on transit. So we're really struggling to how to create more sustainable, livable cities. So I am willing to kind of point out some of these difficult facts because we do have a new vision on what transit can be that can be a much better one. And that is integrating it with all of these new types of shared mobility services. Transit works, conventional transit works best on line haul trips, corridors, dense corridors, connecting one node to another. It does not work very well elsewhere. So it works well in downtown Boston, downtown Manhattan, and there is quite a bit of transit there. Could be more, could be better. But in a big picture, it's very small. You go to the Boston suburbs, transit's very poor there. and very expensive. I know in California now the marginal trip costs sometimes $20-$30 to accommodate and expand service for another rider. Not on average, but in most of the suburban areas, that's true. So what we need and what is happening now is all of these types of shared mobility services, they're starting to work with and talk to the transit operators. 2 years ago, the transit operators thought it was competition and they were hostile to it, but now they're gradually embracing it because now they can pull back and do what they do well. And now they can use these other services, microtransit services that are real-time, app-based, and they can provide the first and last mile service to connect to conventional transit. They can provide accessibility to many more people. I'm at UC Davis. We have a project working in the Central Valley in San Joaquin where we're specifically targeting low-income riders and figuring out a way that we can provide service to them at a fraction of what conventional transit service would provide. So that means we can, our public transportation money, which should be greatly increased, by the way, but even what it has, we can make it go a lot further. And so this is, just so you know exactly what I'm talking about, this is not UberX or the conventional Lyft services, but this is Uber Pool, this is Lyft Line, and these some of these other microtransit companies that have used small vans. So this is a way of providing much better service to a lot more people. We can get from that 3% way up. I mean, I think we can get up to 50% market penetration using what we'll call these mix of transit services. So I think that's for the, and this option didn't even exist a few years ago. And that's, we need to restructure our thinking to do that. And transit operators are starting to see that. There's a operator in Florida that actually is paying people to use Uber. There was a development in San Francisco where they made a deal, Uber made a deal with a developer so that the developer would provide less parking space, and in return people would get a pass, a transit pass that they could also use for Uber Pool services. So this is a great topic. So I would encourage all of you to start thinking about this, because this is a revolution even as important as electrification of vehicles. Tiffany should answer that one. Yeah, active trend. I mean, we need, like, I live in Davis, and I just moved there a few years ago. I used to commute long distance, and I have all these colleagues that talked about, bicycling and walking and livable communities, and I go, oh, yeah, it sounds all good. But now that I experience it, first I lived in Sacramento for a while and experience it now. And it's such an improvement in ways that are difficult to quantify. It's a sense of community, it's healthfulness, and it saves a lot of money, and it's good for the environment. It's good in almost all ways. Now, it doesn't work for everyone, but I think the mistake we're making is we're not investing more in that. So I see money going into bike. So now they're doing $100 million or $200 million for bike paths. It's a trivial amount of money, because all they're doing is striping the roads for the most sense. Most of us are not feeling safe on those striped lanes. We want, actually separate right-of-ways that are at least separated from vehicles. I know the 20-year-old guys are fine with, driving downtown San Francisco and mixed in with the cars, and they think that's a desirable goal, but for the rest of us it's not. So that is a major shift that I think we need, and I'd like to be seeing with transportation funding and transportation policy and how cities think about it. And we're moving in that direction. You see that the cities are realizing it, but they just don't have the resources. So it really comes back to rethinking and restructuring how we finance transportation. And that ties back to SB 375 as well, which is probably the biggest weakness of it, is that we don't have a mechanism for how to actually use money to support cities, you know, doing the right things on via SB 375 and creating livable communities and low carbon transportation and so on.
I was just going to tag on. I mean, and nothing specific on mass transit or anything, but the conversation to me, I mean, it really indicates just how complicated it is. I mean, when we're talking about essentially transforming the way that we live, the way that we move around, we're talking about transforming the economy. It's not a simple kind of cut and dry thing that we say, well, we're going to do this or we're going to do that. I mean, it is. It's going to require deep, thoughtful analysis, and I think it's going to require everybody being at the table.
And we agree on that.
I love it. See, look, consensus.
Finally.
These conversations are good. But, you know, the bottom line is that analysis needs to be done. And we do need to continue to work towards that. And it's only with that we're going to be able to figure out how to essentially crack the code.
With that kumbaya moment, do you want to, I mean, it's 10:24. Should we stop?
All right. Go have some cake.
With that, thank you. Thanks, everyone. Thank you to the panelists very much.